Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. At the moment, there is arguably no greater threat to this country and perhaps others in the free world than that represented by electromagnetic pulse and other forms of attack, for that matter, cyber attack, physical sabotage, even solar storms, to the critical infrastructure of modern societies, namely their electric grids. If they've not been protected, they are highly vulnerable, and bad guys know it. So too does our first guest. He is Thomas Popick. He is the chairman, the president, and a director of an indispensable organization, the Foundation for Resilient Societies. He is an MIT graduate as well as an MBA from the Harvard Business School. He served in the United States Air Force, rising to the rank of captain. He's deeply knowledgeable and has done incalculable good in terms of exposing for the rest of us to address and correct the vulnerabilities of our electric grid. He's here to talk a little bit about that in the face of some rather direct threats to it from, among others, North Korea. Tom Popick, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. It's so good to have you.
Good to be here, Frank.
So let's talk about what we are hearing from Kim Jong-un and his pals in North Korea. It's my understanding, Tom, that they have, in fact, now connected the proverbial dots between their nuclear capabilities and what is arguably the soft underbelly of our society, our grid.
I think that that's correct. The North Koreans have made a specific threat to conduct an electromagnetic pulse attack, or to have the capability for that attack. That would affect the U.S. electric grid. And of course, as we're seeing right now in Puerto Rico, without a functioning electric grid, it's very difficult for modern societies to sustain their populations.
Yeah. I want to come back to Puerto Rico in a minute, but just take a moment to talk, Tom, about this EMP phenomenon. There are experts, as you know, who insist that there's really nothing to worry about here. There are electric utilities who tell us that they've got everything under control. You've studied this deeply. You've been deeply involved as well with the federal regulatory system that is supposed to oversee and assure the resiliency of our grid. How serious a problem does a threat like North Korea's, the possibility that they could, in fact, get a nuclear weapon over our country and detonate it, to the functioning, perhaps for long periods of time, putting it out of action, the grid?
It's a serious technical threat for which the U.S. electric grid is currently unprotected. There's a number of different technical characteristics of the electromagnetic pulse weapon. There's multiple ways that that kind of weapon detonated at high altitude over the United States could cause a cascading failure of America's electric grid. I should also say that currently the electric utilities have not protected against that threat. They believe protection against that threat is a duty of the Department of Defense, not private companies.
And it turns out that the private companies own most of the grid, so we've got the Defense Department saying, well, no, it's not our job, it's theirs. Even though, as you've taught me, Tom Popick, the United States military is heavily dependent upon the civilian grid in this country to perform its vital missions. Is that right?
Well, that is correct. On a short-term basis, the most critical military installations have backup generators, which could power their operations. But on a long-term basis, 99% of the installations within the continental United States are dependent upon the commercial electric grid.
And to the extent that the grid goes down, lots of bad things eventuate. And turning to the Puerto Rico situation, where not an attack by some hostile power, but the force of Mother Nature has simply devastated that island, but particularly its critical infrastructure. Talk a little bit about the insights that we should have now about how critically important it is that we make that grid resilient.
Certainly. Let's talk about Puerto Rico. First, we need to remember that there are 3.4 million U.S. citizens on the island of Puerto Rico. That society cannot function without an electric grid. The electric power in Puerto Rico is almost entirely down right now. The long-distance transmission lines have been taken out, and also what we call the distribution, that's the local neighborhood power lines, that's not working either. What immediate effect is that having? Well, foremost, the water and sanitation systems aren't working in much of Puerto Rico. As of yesterday, about half of Puerto Rico population did not have potable water. The media was a little late to cover this particular aspect of the story, the critical infrastructure aspect. This critical infrastructure crisis in Puerto Rico is not going away anytime soon.
And Tom Popick, just for calibration purposes, how long can people survive without potable water?
A person can survive without water for only a few days. Without potable water, people might be able to survive for some period of time, but there's going to be a lot of casualties because there's going to be all sorts of waterborne illnesses that people will get. And really, there's the potential for hundreds or even thousands of casualties in Puerto Rico should this situation persist.
I can't imagine that we're not already seeing them rack them up. There have been some people, we're told, who've been without water for 5 or 6 days now. Tom Popick, let me ask you about one other piece of this that is troubling. The North Koreans have indicated not only that they are intent on taking us down, but that they may detonate a hydrogen bomb, which we know they've done recently, we believe they've done recently, in the atmosphere over the Pacific. Based on your understanding of both the phenomenon of EMP and what it can mean for unprotected assets, both terrestrial and those in space, what might be the consequences were the North Koreans to act on that threat?
The consequences could be dramatic. If you look at the Pacific Ocean, there's a number of populated areas that are U.S. territory or a U.S. state, which could be underneath the detonation. These would include the territory of Guam, the Aleutian Islands in Alaska, and the state of Hawaii. So potentially there's great impacts on those populations. Also, there's impact on other infrastructure. It's really the sort of situation where the detonation of a nuclear weapon in the atmosphere at high altitude, that hasn't occurred since the Starfish Prime test in 1962. That test took down, I believe, all of the functioning satellites in low Earth orbit at that particular point. We have to understand that our modern societies are dependent on space and on satellites, and these kind of high-altitude electromagnetic pulse detonations can cause tremendous damage to the space infrastructure.
Wow, which is obviously orders of magnitude larger as well as more important now than it was in the 1960s. And just so we're clear, Tom, the North Korean detonation of a nuclear weapon need not be literally over Hawaii or the Aleutian Islands or Guam to have an electromagnetic pulse effect. It's a function, as I understand it, of the altitude at which the detonation takes place and line of sight. But is that also operating as well in terms of the line of sight upwards into space and the distances at which satellites might be affected?
Actually, it's a different phenomenon. What would happen with a high altitude nuclear detonation is that electrons would become dislodged from their orbits around atoms and would be up there in the upper atmosphere, and then the satellites would run into those electrons and it would cause damage to the satellites. So that isn't necessarily a phenomenon that would just be within line of sight of the blast, because those free electrons in the orbit would persist for weeks or months.
Tom Popick, chilling stuff. Where can people find out more about the work of the Foundation for Resilient Societies and how can they support it?
I would first recommend our Twitter feed, at Resilient Grid, where we are tweeting updates several times each day. We also have a website, www.resilientsocieties.org. Both of those are excellent sources.
They are indeed, as are you. Come back to us again soon. Tom Popick, thank you very much for your time. Suzanne Schulte joins us. What are we going to do about this regime in North Korea? She's got some ideas right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back, I'm pleased to say, joined by Suzanne Schulte, a personal hero of mine who I've had the privilege of knowing and working with for decades, primarily in her capacity as the president of a wonderful organization, the Defense Forum Foundation. But it also is involved, as is she, quite prominently, with the North Korea Freedom Foundation, which she chairs. She has been actively involved for, well, as long as I can remember, in trying to bring freedom to the people of North Korea. She's done as much as anybody, certainly in the West, to help the rest of us understand the plight of the people in North Korea and the nature of the regime that we're up against there. It's a perfect bookend for the conversation we were just having with Tom Popick about the threats that are emanating from that regime at the moment. So, Suzanne Schulte, welcome back. It's so good to have you.
Thank you so much, Frank. I appreciate the opportunity.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the nature of the regime, Suzanne. We're facing what certainly sound like they're existential threats to this country. And the question occurs, could anybody, particularly this regime in North Korea, actually mean to do us the kind of harm that seems to be in the offing if Kim Jong-un has his way?
Well, I think the thing we have to be really, really focused on is the proliferation of technologies that this regime has been involved in for decades, whether it's chemical weapons or building a nuclear plant in Syria. This is a regime that's been aiding and abetting people that hate us. And although I do not believe that Kim Jong-un would do something that would cause us to take him out, I do believe we have to be concerned about the people who he's giving technology, sharing technologies with, that don't have that fear. In other words, he wants to remain in power. So he's going to push and he's going to threaten and all this fiery rhetoric and invective-filled hating of America, but he won't cross a certain line because he does want to stay in power.
Yeah, well, that's a rather hopeful sign, I have to say. I'm not sure that I've quite got my head around the possibility that he can be deterred, but maybe not some of the people that he's enabling to become threats to us as well. Who do you have in mind in that regard?
Well, when you think about the fact that the plant that Israel blew up some years ago, that was, in fact, North Koreans that were working with them to develop that technology. And this is the thing that we need to be very concerned about, is what they're doing in developing these weapons and sharing them with people that hate our country. And whether it's terrorist groups or whether it's rogue nations, this is what really I'm more fearful of than actually of North Korea itself, because I do believe that Kim Jong-un does want to stay in power. And he's going to push as hard as he can, but he's not going to step over a certain line that would cause us to have a military response. Just to give you an idea, and I think, Frank, I think you made a comment during one of your programs that we're dealing with a genocidal, cold-blooded dictator, and that's what he is. And how did we get to this point? Because for decades, we believed that we were negotiating with North Korea in good faith, but the defectors who've been escaping have been telling us for decades that North Korea is never going to give up its nuclear weapons. It's never.
Suzanne Schulte, this is what's so stunning about all of this, is we know he's a genocidal dictator because he's killing his own people by the millions, and that goes from simply starving them to death to incarcerating them in gulags where they die, you know, of starvation, or killing some of them with, anti-aircraft weapons, for God's sake. So this is a man definitely capable of the ultimate brutalities against innocent civilians. And if he treats his own people that way, I've always thought that's a bad sign for how he might treat ours. But talk a little bit about the insights that you've had into the rather fragile nature of the regime based upon your extensive information operations inside the country, Suzanne, with the North Korea Freedom Foundation.
Well, I can give you just the from the words of the defectors of escape. We just did a large delegation of 18 North Korean defectors that ranged from people that served in the military to served in, as diplomats to people that were just average citizens. And they all told us the same thing. They kept repeating, the truth will set them free. If we can get the truth into North Korea, if we can reach out to the people of North Korea with the reality of what's happening here, that will change everything. And so that's why we're so engaged, and we're doing a daily radio broadcast into North Korea that's produced by defectors. Free North Korea Radio, it's the most popular single program broadcasting into North Korea.
And they're able to receive it. I think this is the stunning thing. For many years, we were told this is the hermit kingdom. Nobody has access to radios. How is that being circumvented?
Well, it's a shortwave transmission, and we use a firm that specializes in overcoming jamming. We are very proud of the fact that we are the most targeted for jamming, which means that it is the radio station that the dictator fears more than any other. In fact, he just put out an assassination hit list, and the director of that of Free North Korea Radio was number one on the list. Number two on the list, interesting enough, was Park Sung-hak. And Park Sung-hak is the North Korean defector who does the balloon launches. So he's sending in information and leaflets, money, shortwave radios into North Korea. The reason why the people of North Korea know about the horrific murder of Otto Warmbier is because the North Korean defectors put together leaflets explaining what happened and then balloon launched hundreds of thousands of these leaflets into North Korea.
And Otto, of course, was the young man whose family has recently been talking quite publicly about the horrible condition he was in when he was finally returned, basically for the death watch. This is so alarming on the one hand and yet encouraging on the other, that we're facing a regime that would do that, not only again to their own people, but to individual Americans and a lot of us, I suspect, if they could. And to the extent that you have been working with these defectors and helping the people of North Korea understand the truth about their regime and the conditions that they are uniquely being afflicted with by it. What is your sense, Suzanne Schulte, as to whether there is a real chance for regime change, which it certainly seems to me is the only hope for avoiding, you know, potentially cataclysmic conflict here?
That is exactly what we need to be working towards. And we need to be doing that by empowering the defectors that have escaped, that have taken up all the kinds of work that we used to do in getting information in. And just to give you a couple of examples, the North Korean People's Liberation Front, it's men and women, because women also are required to have military service. But this is the most pro-American group you'll ever meet. And they are smuggling in USBs with information about what happened in Egypt, what happened in Romania, when the military turned against the dictator in favor of the people. They're aggressively trying to reach out to people in the military. Meanwhile, you have Free North Korea Radio, headed by Kim Sung-min, that's doing this daily radio program, talking about what America's really like. They actually broadcast messages from members of Congress about our hopes and dreams for the people of North Korea. We're broadcasting in there that the relationship between the U.S. and South Korea is why South Korea is the 11th strongest economy in the world and a very prosperous nation, and that that's the same kind of freedom and hope that we want for the people of North Korea, rather than the propaganda which tells them that we are occupying South Korea. So just giving them the truth.
It's so important, and I can't commend enough what you're doing, Suzanne Schulte. And also wanted just to say that, as you know, the House of Representatives has just passed unanimously a law that would help this kind of work on both promoting human rights and distributing uncensored information within North Korea. I hope that that will in part help your activities and the work that you're about. Suzanne Schulte, very quickly, how can people learn more about your work?
It's www.defenseforumfoundation.org.
Check it out, folks. Suzanne Schulte, thank you for joining us. Come back to us again very soon, if you would. Michael Cutler joins us next. We'll talk about the latest turns in the Trump administration's immigration policies. That and more, straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. We're joined by Michael Cutler, a man who has devoted decades of his life to protecting our country, prominently in senior positions in the Immigration and Naturalization Services. He is these days a senior fellow at Californians for Population Stabilization and a very active contributor to the public policy debate, both through his writings at places like Front Page Magazine and Family Security Matters, and not least, as the host of his own radio program on Blog Talk Radio, the Michael Cutler Hour. It's good to have him with us for a few minutes at least. Michael, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Frank.
I'd like to start, Michael, by talking a little bit with you concerning what the president has done most recently in terms of refining, changing, modifying, some might say even eviscerating, the so-called travel ban that he enunciated at the beginning of his administration, then revised subsequently in the face of a lot of judicial pushback. What's your current reading on the president's exercise of his authority to protect our borders by restricting people who are allowed into the country?
Well, you know, I wish the president would stop calling it a travel ban. It's a term that the media came up with. The actual name of the so-called travel ban is Protecting the Nation from Foreign Terrorist Entry into the United States. Maybe the title doesn't roll off the tongue, but it certainly makes its purpose very clear.
And something that is consistent with his responsibilities as president to do.
And as commander-in-chief. Let's not forget that. And so the idea that we allow enemy combatants, spies, and terrorists to easily gain entry into the United States runs contrary to that important mission of national security. But what he has done, and it's remarkable to me that the ACLU and CAIR said it's window dressing, this is just about Islamists, which is crazy. He's added North Korea, Venezuela, and Chad to the list. Chad is a failed state. The Brits have actually removed their embassy from Chad, and our State Department warns Americans to be very wary about entering that troubled country. So there's no way to vet people coming out of Chad, number one. Number two, Venezuela, we know, has been working in close cooperation with Iran. Iran, of course, the parent organizations for Hezbollah and other terrorist organizations. We know that there are terror training camps in the border region, the tri-border region of Brazil, where it abuts with Paraguay and Argentina, which again gets us back to why we need a border wall, but it also explains why there are concerns about people from Venezuela, because we know that there are Iranians entering every week, Iranian shock troops flying directly into Caracas from Tehran.
And getting passports in Venezuela as well.
Yeah, and then you look at North Korea, and certainly these crazy people, their leaders, I don't know how you want to define them, but their goal, apparently, is to do damage to the United States, whether it's by putting spies in our country or saboteurs here. You know, missiles are high-tech wheelbarrows. They're just a way of delivering a weapon. And it would be no less of a coup for them if, God forbid, they could get weapons across our borders or by creating weapons once in the United States or doing other damage to us. So clearly, the focus isn't on a religion. It's on national security. And by the way, if the president was trying to ban Muslims from the United States, he's doing a lousy job. He didn't include Indonesia, which is the most populous Muslim country, Muslim-majority country on the planet.
Michael, this is really an important point. I think that in my own view of this is that there is a need for him to be filtering out people who, as he once put it, don't share our values by virtue of their desire to bring here Sharia. But that is now clearly, if it's in the mix at all, it is much subordinated to the rest of these, you know, sort of restrictions. But I'm afraid we're missing something here.
Yeah, I don't mean to interrupt you, but I want to make a quick point in the limited time that we have. For the courts to say that if people have bona fide relationships in the United States, that is to say they have family members, they're coming for a job, they're coming as students, that's lunacy. If you look at the Tsarnaev brothers, they were part of a family that falsely got political asylum by lying about credible fears to return to Russia. We legalized them. They immediately went back to Russia. Clearly, they were lying. It also would involve the San Bernardino attack, where it was a fiancé who apparently spurred her American spouse-to-be to commit that terrible terrorist attack. We've seen it time and again. We've seen students come here and then seek to use their status as students to learn how to better kill us and then carry out terrorist attacks.
You're making my point. I think this really argues for a much more rigorous screening system. And I think an ideological filter that screens out those who seek to impose this anti-constitutional program of Sharia on us is eminently sensible. Michael, we're going to run out of time, as you say. Let me quickly turn to another area of mutual concern. You've been working with Californians for Population Stabilization. The government of the state of California has now endorsed making the whole state a sanctuary that would be, destabilizing the population, I would argue, among other things. Talk a little bit about what they've done and its implications.
Well, I just wrote my most recent article for Front Page Magazine was California poised to provide sanctuary to alien criminals and terrorists. And you know, it's remarkable the use of language going back to Jimmy Carter to no longer use the term alien to declare anybody who's a foreign national an immigrant. So they're saying, well, we're going to protect the immigrants from immigration authorities. The terminology is a contradiction in concepts. It's under our immigration laws that we admit more lawful immigrants than the rest of the world combined. As an immigration inspector, which I did at the beginning of my career for 4 years, I admitted many more aliens into the United States than I denied entry to. And I spent a year as an adjudications officer. I approved many more applications for green cards than I denied. The true immigrant needs no protection from immigration law enforcement if they're abiding by the law. That what they do need protection from are criminals and terrorists who set up shop within their ethnic immigrant communities, and not just from Latin America, but from all over the world, because human nature is human nature.
Right, and so do the rest of us, by the way.
Absolutely, but my point is, if they're talking about protecting the immigrants, the true immigrants are at greatest risk of violence from the criminal element within their ethnic immigrant communities, but that somehow seems to escape detection, also escaping the coverage, is the fact that even illegal aliens who provide actionable intelligence to law enforcement can be granted visas to remain in the United States and even bring family members here. There's no better way of protecting these people than to have them cooperate with immigration. What they're doing in California and in sanctuary cities around the country is to crippling any efforts at immigration law enforcement, which, as the 9/11 Commission pointed out, were key to national security and preventing the entry and embedding of terrorists.
Yeah. And to the extent that the state of California now has formally instituted this arrangement, Michael, is it reasonable to expect that we will see, indeed, more criminal, illegal aliens in that state? And what is to keep them in that state? I mean, they obviously will enjoy sanctuary there, but you've been warning all of us that people migrate to other parts of the country and making all of us, as you said, I think on many occasions on our program and elsewhere, border states for that matter.
Well, we have 50 border states. First of all, most terrorists don't enter the United States through our porous borders, land borders, but through international airports with visas, or under the insane visa waiver program, or by stowing away on ships. You know, every state is a border state. When a community welcomes in aliens who are here illegally, some of them may just be looking to work, which creates enough problems by itself, but so many are fugitives from justice in other countries. They're violent, wanted for heinous crimes. They might be coming here to carry out a terrorist attack. And the point is that we spend over $14 billion a year on customs and border protection. If it doesn't matter how you come here, then why are we bothering with the charade of inspecting passengers on international airline flights or putting up the border patrol? If you can get past the border patrol, now you're home free. That kind of madness, when I last testified before the Senate and I talked back then about the Obama policies, I said that it had effectively fired the starter's pistol for aspiring illegal aliens from around the world. And for those folks, the border of the United States is the finish line. California is aiding, abetting, inducing, and encouraging illegal immigration and shielding and harboring aliens who shouldn't be here. If you or I did that as civilians, we'd be committing a felony. I hope the administration finds an aggressive strategy to stop the lunacy.
Begin prosecuting others for criminal activity, including those in government. Much more to talk about with you, Michael Cutler. We have to leave it at that for the moment. Thank you for the terrific work you're doing, notably, but not exclusively, at Front Page Magazine and Family Security Matters, but also with us as well as in your own radio program. Check it out at Blog Talk Radio. Michael, thanks. Join us again soon, if you would. Next up, we'll talk with Diana West about, well, among other things, Roy Moore's success in Alabama last night and what it might mean for Donald Trump and us. That and more straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back and joined as we have the wonderful opportunity to do by our friend Diana West, a longtime syndicated columnist and now blogger extraordinaire at dianawest.net. You can also find her writings on the bestseller list in places like, well, Death of the Grown-Up and American Betrayal, the secret assault on our nation's character. She is kind enough to give us time each week, and it's always a delight to have a chance to visit with her. Diana, thanks for doing so today.
Oh, thank you. Wonderful to be with you.
Well, let's start with an interesting, perhaps even seismic shift in electoral politics in America. After the Trump phenomenon, there has been a sort of post-Trump phenomenon, and now we seem to be back to the sort of insurgency that brought Donald Trump to power with the victory over the swamp by Roy Moore, the new Republican Senate candidate to replace Jeff Sessions. Diana West, tell us about your thoughts on how this came about, despite the very high profile and active intervention by Donald Trump on behalf of the swamp creature.
Yes, well, I don't know what I can tell you because it's all very inexplicable, but I do believe that President Trump was rather ambivalent about his candidate as he campaigned for him and always made it clear that he would certainly campaign hard for Judge Moore should he be the victor. So this was a very strange kabuki theater that I don't think we really know the backstory on. The outcome is good. Certainly, Judge Moore supports the Trump agenda more than the Trump White House does. And so that is a good thing. And we've seen the dynamic of Breitbart and Steve Bannon and so on bringing out the crowds down in Alabama, which would be probably the best possible state for this kind of an insurgency, if we want to call it that. You know, it will be tested in states that are not so red. So, you know, we'll see how this goes going forward into places where the McConnell machine, et cetera.
Yeah, like presumably in Tennessee, where we'll see the replacement of Bob Corker, thanks be to God, taking place next year. And I think it will be an interesting race because I think there will be at least one rock-ribbed conservative in it, and hopefully we'll see history repeating here. But Diana, because you have been a champion of this movement that Donald Trump tapped into, a lot of people call it the Trump movement, but I really think it's bigger than him, and it will be interesting to see where it goes if he continues to sort of embrace the swamp and some of its agenda. But what are your thoughts on the importance of Donald Trump returning to the kinds of issues that helped get him elected president? I'm thinking particularly about our mutual interest in defeating Sharia supremacism at our borders and beyond.
What are my thoughts in terms of, should he return to this? Yes, he should return to his own agenda. I think it is the Trump agenda only because he tapped into issues or expressed issues that no other politician, no other national politician before him, or had he not come on the scene after him, I do, in my opinion, would have ever articulated. These issues of immigration, issues of Sharia immigration, etc., the America First agenda, these were issues that were supposed to have been long ago and were settled by the swamp, by the establishment. And indeed, nobody stepped out of line. So I think it is the Trump agenda. It is bigger than him in the sense that he unleashed it. Now, where we are with it, we are in a terrible place because are we at a tipping point, to use that extremely overtired phrase, we are past a tipping point, and now we're seeing his own agenda subverted from within in terms of the immigration issues, in terms of the cap on refugees, which is barely a dent. I mean, it's kind of a ridiculous practice. You see all these headlines talking about this 45,000 refugee resettlement cap that is supposed to be announced. You see it framed in terms of lowest numbers ever as if it's a change, but seriously, it's merely a fractional downward shift.
Then sort of a correction to what it used to be before it was bumped up dramatically by Obama. But on the immigration issue, we were talking about it with Michael Cutler in the previous segment. I would be interested in your thoughts about what the president does seem to be doing. And I discern the fine hand of H.R. McMaster in this, as in so many of these deviations, is kind of shifting away from the whole idea that he campaigned on, that he was going to stop people who wish to do us harm, who, more to the point, don't share our values, as he put it famously on the 15th of August of last year, from coming to this country. It implied, at the very least, a filter that would screen out some of these jihadists before they get here. And I'm struck particularly, I don't know if you've had a chance to look at it, Dinah West, but our friend Andy McCarthy has a terrific piece at National Review Online about this, in which he particularly warns that if you don't try to stop the ideology that these folks adhere to from leaching in, you're going to simply have people who aren't perhaps jihadists when they migrate becoming in due course a threat inside the United States. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, it's a great tragedy and it's a great danger because he campaigned as if he was very prepared to remember his bowl of Skittles speeches. He was prepared to have a ban on immigration from Islamic countries. I mean, this was obviously what he was discussing, what he was looking at. How extreme vetting was going to pan out was a question mark. But the idea that there were people and there were ideologies that existed in this world that are antithetical to our own flourishing is something that was very front and center of his platform, of his agenda that he articulated, and that people did understand essentially as a ban on immigration from Islamic countries. And this was constantly tested by pollsters who would go to his rallies and find out that the numbers in support of such a ban, without any fancy language or nuance, was extremely high, was upwards around, 60 to 75%, numbers like that, very strong.
Well, it's basically common sense is what it comes down to, I think.
It comes down to common sense, and which is something that has been stamped out of us. This is, again, part of what Trump, is responsible for reviving, even as he has lost it himself and seems to be completely distracted and off on tangents. And, it's a terrible, terrible situation.
Yeah. Let me ask you, because this outbreak of common sense seems to have been manifesting itself even in Germany this past week, as Germans gave a significant vote to the Alternative for Germany, Alternative for Deutschland, as it's called. Daniel, what are your thoughts on that? You follow closely developments in Europe. Is this also perhaps a sea change?
Well, I don't think it's a sea change. I think it's a good thing. I'm happy about it. And yet, how happy can we be when we see a sea change that ultimately comes down to 12-13% of the vote in the midst of a rape jihad, in the midst of rampant hijra, rampant mass Muslim immigration, thanks to the policy, the specific policy, the open borders stated policy of Angela Merkel, who is returned to office for, I believe it's the fourth time. This is how negatively I will view this. Is it a death rattle? Can we call it something as sad as that? Or is it simply a nascent movement? Well, there isn't really time for nascent movements in Europe at this time. So this is why it's a strike in the right direction. But I mean, we're very far along, and Germany is very, very a damaged country. It's a battleground, and this is all they can muster. It's a sad statement.
But it will be interesting to see, how hopefully, how it turns in a parliamentary system into a significant block. We'll be watching that closely, as I know will you. Dinah, thank you so much for your time today. As always, it's great to visit with you. We'll look forward to doing so again next week and to talking to the rest of you again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.